Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Gillian DeBias. David Jenkins, editor of Little White Lies magazine, is my guest today and will be talking through a tale of emotional growing pains in the diary of a teenage girl. We'll find out how the British government might handle a nuclear attack in War Book. And we'll round things off with a bit of Russian sci-fi in Hard to Be a God. That's all to come right here on the Monocle Arts Review on Monocle 24. Hello, David, and welcome again to the studio. Now, we've got quite a variety of films to talk about today, and we're going to start lighthearted with Marielle Heller's directorial debut in The Diary of a Teenage Girl. Set in the 1970s San Francisco, this film follows 15-year-old Minnie as she searches for love and acceptance and discovers boys and drugs. David, at its heart, what is this film about?
Well, it's really interesting. Just to go on a very short tangent to start off,
I'll indulge you.
The film is made the headlines recently because the BBFC, the company who certificate movies for give them age limits, have given this film an 18 rating, which means that a lot of its intended audience, which is kind of 14, 15-year-old teenage girls who are a period in their life where they're kind of discovering things about themselves and other people, can't actually see the movie.
So do you understand why it was given that certificate? Is it very explicit?
Well, I'm not sure it goes to levels. I mean, it's all very, very, I mean, I don't want to use the word tasteful because that seems like it's kind of, you know, damning it with faint praise. But like, no, it's done in a really interesting, naturalistic, very matter-of-fact way. I mean, it's not like the sex scenes in this movie, you know, you suddenly hear kind of wah-wah pedal guitars it's all done very, very, you know, in a very sort of matter-of-fact, removed, unsentimental way. That I think you know is going to resonate to people who have experienced those things before in their life, and also who are kind of going through it at the same time as well.
Well, let's hear a little clip from the film. This is Kristen Wiig, who plays Minnie's mum, speaking to her in the kitchen.
You know, you're not going to have that bod forever, man. I know that's not very feminist of me to say, but you might be happier if you put it out there a little bit. You know, wear some makeup, wear a skirt once in a while. Jesus. Get some attention.
You have a kind of power, you know, you don't know it yet.
And that was a clip from The Diary of a Teenage Girl. I mean, listening to it, is it told from a teenager's perspective, or is it like every man?
No, it's definitely told from her perspective. You're kind of experiencing things and people as Minnie is experiencing them as well. And in the clip, you hear her mother, played by Kristen Wiig, who is kind of all this stuff with Minnie is going on under her nose, but she doesn't really know about it. And when she eventually does find out, there's this kind of mixed feeling of you know, sadness and almost a little tang of jealousy as well, that, you know, these kind of glory days are past her and she's not able to sort of indulge in these things anymore. So the sort of mother-daughter relationship is very kind of bittersweet in the film. And it's made all the more kind of tangled by the fact that the man that they are both hankering for is the same man. So
always adds a little bit of spice. I mean, I think the filmic treatment is interesting in the way that the character of Minnie fantasizes about being a cartoonist or wants to be a cartoonist. So part of her life is very much about drawing, and this seeps into the film. How does it manifest itself?
Well, it's in a really interesting way. I mean, you do see there are sort of interludes in the film where her drawings come to life and she's kind of visualizing things in her head, and she becomes obsessed with this comic book artist who she kind of gets into a correspondence with. But what's really interesting about the film is, in the end, it ends up being as much about being an artist as it is a kind of rite of passage film. Because, I mean, it ends up sort of saying all these experiences, all these experiences she's having, she'll be able to use, and they can feed into her art, and they'll be inspiration for her. And it's kind of the moral of the film, I guess. I mean, moral is probably the wrong word, but the sort of message, I guess, is that you know, you need to have these experiences to be able to express yourself and understand yourself and translate those experiences to other people. So, that's essentially how the design and art element works within the film.
Tell us a little bit about the director and how she got her hands on this project.
Well, Mariel Heller, yeah, she's an American director. This is her debut movie. She acts as well, but apparently she cold called the writer of the graphic novel upon which the film is based and hectored her for many years to say that she wanted to make this film and that she loved it. And the writer, Phoebe Glockner, eventually relented and they made it into, originally it was going to be a theatre production. I'm not sure if it ever became a theatre production, but it swiftly went on to become a movie. I think she was working on it for a very long time. She went through the whole sort of Sundance Lab Institute where she kind of was, you know, this was her kind of big project and she was learning as she was making it at the same time. So the film is really a... it shows that the system does work sometimes, I guess, even though it's a sort of slightly marginal artsy system off to the left. So,
well, good to hear. The Diary of a Teenage Girl is out today in America and UK cinemas and tomorrow in Australia. And if you happen to be living in Sweden, the Netherlands and Germany, do look out for it over the course of the coming months. Now, let's move on to our second film of the day. War Book is a British film set in the political backrooms of London as a government minister and his aides simulate what they might do if there was a devastating nuclear attack. Now, it's set mostly in one room. It sounds more like a play than a film. How does it unfold, and does it unfold effectively on screen?
I think you're definitely right in that suggestion. It does, when I'm watching it, you do feel that you could maybe turn the visuals off and leave the sound on and hear it as a sort of radio play or something. But it's a very classical chamber piece. It's all set in, mostly set in this one room. There's a few interludes in kind of adjoining corridors it's very kind of 12 Angry Men, you know, that kind of setup. And there are a few interludes where you get just one-on-one moments between characters. But I mean, the setup, as you say, is there's this introduction explaining that countries across the world, civil services across the world, have these war games where a simulated attack is made up for these 12 people, and they then have to decide how to respond to that attack. And in this case, there is the 12 people enter the room, and they over the course of 3 days and three separate sessions, you know, they have their morals challenged and their ethics challenged and their politics challenged, and they become different people, and you know, they learn and they bond and they shout at each other, and it kind of goes where you expect it. However, it is a very interesting way of it's the sort of disaster movie without the disaster, if you know what I mean. You know, there's no CGI volcanoes or earthquakes or, you know, the earth caving in or anything like that. But the disaster that it's all set around is a nuclear attack on Mumbai by Pakistan. And then it kind of, I guess, just flowers out from that, mushrooms out, I guess.
Well, we're going to hear a clip of the film now.
What will it be used for, this game we're playing?
It's a useful way of testing responses.
The hope is the people making these decisions will know how to rise above their personal problems and do their job.
Yes?
Do we have an estimate on the warning time yet? An hour? 4 minutes?
The two countries are now at war. There have been riots and widespread looting.
We must meet up with our allies.
By standing side by side with the Americans, or rather, just behind them, like always.
You need to tuck your tail in.
They're called a deterrent because they're intended to deter.
They're called a deterrent because we're not supposed to use them.
What are the options?
Hide or fight.
A sound of the British film War Book. Now, even in that, you sense so much of the drama. You touched on it a bit. This is not an action thriller like Mission Impossible, and yet you sense this rising fear and tension just by almost the rhythm of the dialogue there.
Well, it does. It is in that kind of, you know, the dynamics, I guess, are in a kind of constant crescendo. So, you know, as the film goes on, the voices get louder. And by the end, it's there's quite a fair bit of shouting and swearing and, you know, let's say passion.
But I suppose the drama and the performances rather than the special effects.
Oh, no, there is no special effects. I mean, it's all one, a very bland sort of grey-brown boardroom with, you know, some pastries and water on the table, and they just duke it out. Nothing. It's just them and their voices and talking and voting on various responses to the kind of escalating crisis.
Well, War Book has been screened with much acclaim at film festivals, including last year's London Film Festival, and it's only now that it's being screened in cinema, so do catch it if you can. And we're going to end with a Russian sci-fi film called Hard to Be a God. It's about a group of scientists who travel to the planet Arkanar, which is similar to Earth, but some 800 years behind, and it's stuck in the Dark Ages. Now, fundamentally, David, this is a Russian film. What is it about?
Well, you say in the description there that it's a sci-fi, and I think people when it comes to talking about this film, I think people have found it very difficult to actually find a generic term that actually fits it, because it's one of those movies where it's an oddity, an outlier. There's nothing quite like it out there. There's, you know, I've certainly never seen like anything like it before, and will unlikely see anything like it again. So,
well, before we find out what that looks like, let's see what it sounds like.
Такая же, как Земля, но не догнавшая ее лет на 800.
That actually sounds quite gentle for a movie that is being talked about for all its gore and rather sort of traumatic elements to it. Talk us through the whole kind of visual feel of this storytelling.
Well, I mean, this director, just to add, the director Alexei German, who died in 2013 before the film actually was released, and it was completed by his son, who is also a filmmaker. But I mean, I think the best way to describe the sort of feel of watching this film is experiential. I mean, there's no story and there's no characters and there's not conventional dialogue that you would have in a movie, and there's no story and there's no progression, and it's literally, what would it be like to be dropped into a world and just experience it firsthand? And you essentially have this character who you're following around, and you just see and feel what he sees and feels. I mean, in that clip there, you had a little bit of music in there, and I think that is kind of an expression of the film. It's the cinematic equivalent of atonal free jazz, I guess.
In black and white.
In black and white, yes, of course.
But there is the scientists. They've gone back in time. Is there, and they're finding a rather hellish place, is there allegory in this, the Middle Ages? This is a Russian film.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's kind of, you could see it as being about modern Russia or a satire on modern Russia. But I mean, in terms of, you know, the fact that these characters are scientists, it's mentioned in an intertitle at the beginning of the film, but then there is no, if you miss that intertitle, there is no evidence at all that they are there for scientific reasons. I mean, the only way that you can kind of deduce that there's any difference is that, you know, this character you're following is obviously a little bit more intelligent than the kind of these medieval 13th century peasants who are just wallowing around in mud and spitting and just being generally foul. I mean, it's kind of, you know, phantasmagoric, I guess, is a word you could use to describe it, because it's just relentless. It's just absolutely relentless for 3 hours as well. I mean, it's just things being thrown at you constantly, and it's very, very overwhelming. And it's one of those films where you'll know in 10 minutes whether you want to sit there for 3 hours.
I was reading that The director spent 4 decades planning this film and another dozen making it. Can you understand why? And is it the kind of film that, love it or hate it, it is going to become a classic?
I think so. It's definitely a film for the long haul. I mean, I think it's one of those movies as well that even if you personally see it and you feel repelled by it or bored by it or sickened by it, I think it's kind of, you'd be hard pressed to honestly say it wasn't a great movie, because I mean everything is up there on the screen. There's things in this movie that you think, I cannot understand how that effect was achieved or how they managed to achieve that production design, or you know, it's kind of mind boggling in that way. And I mean, he has kind of three of his most recent films were made, I think, with 15 years in between each. And I mean, in fact, for his second movie, it's called Crustolia of My Car from 1999. And I remember reading a review by the critic Jonathan Romney, who saw it in Cannes, and he said, well, this film started, and as soon as it started, you could hear all these seats flapping up because people were just walking out in droves. But such was the film and the atmosphere and the kind of musicality of it, but that sound actually fit in with the film. It was it almost added to the atmosphere of the film itself. And I think that the same definitely goes for this. I mean, you know, you could watch it in a rainstorm or something, and you'd still get that kind of electric atmosphere that it has. But yeah, I mean, I don't know if I've overdone it with a hyperbole here, but like, it really is just out there on its own. It's an island of a movie, I guess.
Well, Hard to Be a God has been showing on the International Film Festival circuit over the past year, and it's now rolling out mostly in art house cinemas around the world. But by the sounds of that one, again, to get a ticket for. And that brings us to the end of today's show. Thank you to my guest, David Jenkins. You've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Gillian De Bias. My producer was Holly Fisher, and my researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco. We'll be back same time next Monday for our top art picks, but for now, goodbye from me, and thanks for listening.